Welcome to a new episode of The Brand Called You. I've brought some very, very interesting people to you over the last few months. Today, I have a friend and a neighbor, Shilpa Sharma. Shilpa, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure.
Shilpa is from St. Xavier's, Mumbai. She's an MBA from Mumbai. She's worked for Linta, Cadbury, Marico, and Fab India. And she's an entrepreneur. So Shilpa, talk to us a little bit about your early life, your early career in the corporate world, and then what made you become an entrepreneur?
You know, early years were spent wanting to do something out of the ordinary. Mm-hmm. I mean, I grew up in a conservative Punjabi family. Good girls didn't go out to work. Mm-hmm. And you basically built a life around being good daughter, good mm-hmm. mother, good wife, and so on and so forth. But I was quite determined not to end up being that person. Early days, there were some battles to be fought at home, which I did. But they held me in very good stead. I started my career in advertising, realized very quickly that that was not quite what I really wanted.
This was Lintas.
This was the Lintas, okay. Yeah. I mean, it was a great opportunity. Oh, you know, we were a bunch of like 20 management trainees, and this is way back in 1989. But I think one of the things that I've been always very conscious and mindful of is if there's an inner voice which is telling you this isn't quite what you know you want to be, then do something to change that. You know, it's not about learning to live with a situation. So I moved very quickly to brand, and Cadbury was great in many which ways, because I also met my husband there. But okay. That also meant that my tenure with Cadbury's didn't last for more than about a year and a half. And then he continued, and you know, I moved on to Marico. Marico was a great opportunity, yes. Because it was one of the most progressive Indian FMCG companies. And they were winning awards for organization culture and people orientation year after year. It was a great time. I spent 4 years there. Got to work on a Parachute, the big story. Yeah,
quite an iconic brand.
Iconic brand. And then, but you know, the thing is that there was always something gnawing at the bottom of my heart. I mean, there was this mindless amount of number crunching that one had to do all the time. And then end up in a situation where you always had to agree with the boss, because the boss is always right. I think the time, I took a year off when my son was born. And in the course of that time, I mean, chance meeting with William Bissell at Fab India many years ago, translated into an opportunity that presented itself. And I said, yes, you know, this is something that I'd love to do. Always wanted to surround myself by all that beautiful product. And in September 1998, I joined Fab India.
I remember reading about you where you said that you asked William Bissell, why don't you have a store in Mumbai?
He
says, why don't you open it?
So, you know, I mean, the thing is that I think it was an opportunity. It was also the right time to be there, because William had just come back from the US and had taken over the reins of the business after John passed away. And I got an opportunity to be part of the Fab India growth story. I was also that person who was never satisfied with just what I was hired to do. I was raring to go and wanting to do more and more. And I think in the 12 years that I spent with Fab India, there were many opportunities to do just what everything that I wanted to do. You know, I didn't shy away from taking on responsibility, you know, for decisions that I believed in. And if you're willing to be accountable and if you're willing to carry the can on your decisions, there's nothing that stops you. And that environment was very, very nurturing.
And what would be some of your, say, key learnings in Fab India? Because it's an amazing brand which has now grown all over the world.
It is an amazing brand, yes. And I, hold them in tremendous, in very high regard. I feel that Fab India is instrumental in making me the person I am today.
Okay.
Professionally and in many ways personally as well. I think some of my biggest learnings over there were really, how to stand up for yourself and take decisions and the responsibility for those decisions. And, you know, people ask me all the time, you know, so how did you choose to be an entrepreneur? I think my 12 years at Fab India were a stint in entrepreneurship without actually being one, right? I was an employee, but I didn't feel like one.
Correct.
And some of the opportunities in terms of what there is out there waiting to be tapped, you know. I allowed myself to think of possibilities which were outside of the role I was hired to you know, perform. But it was okay, you know. I think to be able to launch jewelry when you're actually driving store operations.
Correct.
You don't hear of these things in structured, professionally run, process-driven organizations. Like I said, maybe it was about the way we were at that point in time. I mean, I got the opportunity to open about, over 100 stores in a span of 10 years. To be customer-facing, to be able to understand what makes, you know, women, largely women, tick, what they look for, what makes them happy, and what it is that we as a business could do. So I think to understand what empowerment truly means, is the opportunity that I got.
Correct.
And I never shied away from asking too many questions. And that, I think, also helped.
And then what drove you to become an entrepreneur? What was that calling?
For the kind of person I am, if there is an element of predictability in my life and I can see, how it's going to be on a day-to-day basis, I know something's going to have to change. That's one. And the other thing is that, we outgrow organizations and we sometimes become too big for our boots. And I think my aspirations for the business became larger than the shoe I was wearing. And clearly, it was time for me to move on and chart a new canvas of growth. Okay. By then, I'd been working for other people for about 20 years. And I felt that, I didn't really want anyone else, working for someone else, cramp my style. Personal growth agendas have to be parked on the side.
Correct.
When you're in a full-time job.
Correct.
And I think I was ready to move on and, do things my way, the way...
And that is when Jaipur happened.
No, Jaipur actually took some time to happen because
okay.
my entrepreneurial journey started with consulting
okay.
and followed very quickly with a small travel venture
okay.
called Breakaway.
Okay.
And these are the two things that I was doing when a chance meeting with, Puneet Chawla, who's my founding partner at Jaipur,
okay.
So presented this opportunity.
Let's go chronologically then.
Yeah.
Let's talk of Breakaway.
Yes.
Tell me about this business and... I mean, your email also had Breakaway in it.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. So, Breakaway started off as a pet project. Mm-hmm. But the truth is that in not working full time for anyone anymore, I realized I suddenly had a lot more free time on my hands. I'm a voracious traveler. I could spend my last penny traveling. And I realized that my approach to travel, the way I like to travel, is what I want to be able to share with people. We have what we call a very beyond the brochure approach. You ask me what that means. Beyond the brochure is really looking for that needle in a haystack.
Okay.
So the unseen and the seen. There is a Rajasthan that everybody knows and there is a Rajasthan nobody knows.
So give me an example of what would you show in Rajasthan, which is beyond the brochure.
So we take you to places like Bera and Basi,
okay.
And Kota that most people don't know about. People associate Rajasthan with, Jaipur, Jodhpur, Udaipur.
And palaces.
Yeah, and palaces. The truth is that there are unknown leopard camps in Rajasthan, which
okay.
people don't go looking for because, for them, national parks in Rajasthan stop with Ranthambore, begin and end
yeah.
with Ranthambore. But the truth is that there is a lot for somebody who's willing to look.
Mm.
Similarly, there's a beyond the brochure Assam, which goes beyond Kaziranga.
Mm.
There's a beyond the brochure Kutch, which goes beyond the beautiful textiles. Yeah. So, it's about extinct volcanoes.
So I'm going to come back to you on
Kutch
because that's the place that we have been planning to go.
Okay, lovely.
So hopefully
very
you can curate it for us.
Yeah,
then.
Yeah. And travel, is really very, very uplifting.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's taught me many things. It's taught me how to be compassionate and empathetic in a way I never was. It's taught me to see much more than what is visible.
Correct.
To look and not just see. And
So tell me now, Indians are traveling a lot more than they used to.
They do.
I'm also, my wife and I are very, very great travelers and really travel quite extensively around the world.
Mm.
But, as Indians are beginning to travel, we're also beginning to see the ugly side of Indian travelers. How do you cope with that?
So, I think... a little bit of discipline, mindfulness, and respect for the other is all things that we learn, our values that we learn growing up. And when I see badly behaved people around, you know, not just when they travel, but even otherwise, I think it's an outcome of poor upbringing. How to cope with it? I mean, you take a deep breath and you try and sensitize people. I have to say that in the kind of work I do, I don't really come across that lot very much, but they're in my face every time I'm on a flight, you know, every time I'm at the airport. And I have to say it's not easy. But yeah, I mean, from the breakaway perspective, the kind of people who travel with us are people like you and I. And that makes my job much easier vis-a-vis Indian travelers. But you know, what the apathy that one sees around is just outrageous. Yeah, I really wish we would just
I agree. And I guess also internationally.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I went to Australia was, I think, in 1990. And that time I used to wonder when we will start to see some Indian food coming on menu, because everything was Chinese. Over the years, suddenly Indians are now welcome there. You know, so I think the countries that are receiving Indian travelers are also beginning to adapt.
Countries are beginning to adapt, but I think the gap between how people need to conduct themselves and how the world traveler conducts themselves is a huge one. And we talk about food when we get to food, but you know,
that's so what's after Breakaway, you founded Jaipur.
Yeah, so you know, Jaipur, I wasn't planning on it.
Okay.
And I was having lots of fun with doing advisory work in fashion and lifestyle and building my travel venture, which was really just me. I didn't have anybody else's aspirations to manage. And I was a happy soul. But a chance meeting, you know, over a winter breakfast really presented an opportunity, which I thought was, you know, worth exploring. And I'd started with you know, Puneet saying he wanted to do something online. He just didn't know what to sell. And, you know, there I was, got these dreams and aspirations, you know, for what I was doing at Fabinder. And things that I believed in, which came out of very, very deep convictions behind what I felt the customer was ready for. So I said, okay, you know, let's just give this a shot and see where we can take it.
And talk to us a little bit about Jaipur. What is the scope of work you handle there?
So Jaipur, I mean, I drove curation of product. I drove storytelling and communication. And basically, you know, what the ethos behind the brand was going to be. And what is it that we stood for? You know, Jaipur was all about India's most beautiful. Jaipur was quintessentially modern India.
Okay.
I mean, you know, I wanted us to be the ambassador of modern Indian style around the world.
And is this fabric alone or something more?
No, it's textiles and jewelry and lifestyle product across categories, actually.
Okay. And all Rajasthani or?
Not at all. It's all product from all over the country. I mean, people ask me, you know, why we are called Jaipur. And my answer to that is that Jaipur as a city, from perspective of people all around the world, is it stands for India's most beautiful in terms of architecture, in terms of textiles, in terms of you know, craft forms and culture. And it's a good representation of everything that we wanted to be. So it just seemed.
And Jaipur is an online.
It's an online portal, but there are two stores. And, you know, the idea is to use the stores to be able to talk to audiences who are wary of shopping online and to gently nudge them into, you know, going online. So, yeah, I mean, it's an omni-channel.
So, you know, you said you scaled up Fab India to 100 odd stores where you were working on
125 stores,
125
yes.
stores.
Yes.
You're working on Jaipur and you opened two stores and hopefully we'll see more.
Yes.
What have been some of your learnings as you've scaled up?
Many learnings. One, I mean, one of the biggest learnings for me has been that if you believe in something, persist. The other thing is that, you know, have a very, very strong reason to exist. I never, ever wanted to be an also-ran. So, you know, whatever it is that you see of Breakaway, whatever it is that you see of Jaipur, and then subsequently what Poonam and I did with Mustard, the proposition, what we call the minimum value proposition, had to be unique, had to be something that nobody else had ever thought of, ever done. And that is really something that gives you a head start because, you know, there's always someone else out there with more money or deeper pockets who can shout louder than you can.
Correct.
And who'll have you for breakfast before you even wake up. So, didn't want to be that person. And I think the learning with Jaipur was that it was a swim against the tide, because the audience that we were catering to, the discerning, upwardly mobile, quality conscious audience that we were catering to, was not really spending all her time and money shopping online. So how do you, as an online proposition, cater to an audience who's not online? You know, what is it that you need to do to nudge them into moving online? I'd spent 12 years at Fab India. I knew where the gaps were.
Yeah.
I knew what we wanted to be and what we could be, given that online was not their DNA. Having been a retailer for over 20 years, I realized that the economics of brick and mortar retail can be limiting in terms of geographic footprint. But you know, the online space has no boundaries. The challenges are very different. The cost structure is very different. But, you know, we ended up building a brand which became much, much bigger than the business.
Amazing.
And our ability to build the brand in leaps and bounds was governed by the fact that we were online and shipping to over 60 countries worldwide.
Wow.
In a span of less than 2 years.
Amazing. So yeah. First two brands, Breakaway, Jaipur, and then a third brand, Mustard.
Yes.
You know, talk to me about Mustard. What made you get into food? And
you know, I've always followed my heart.
Okay.
I've never had plans. And you know, life has a way of unfolding and presenting opportunities. And then I realized it's up to me whether or not I want to take them. I was having lots of fun with Jaipur. It was consuming me in every which way.
Yeah.
And I was also phasing out of consulting. But Poonam, my dear friend and partner in my consulting practice, wasn't really part of Jaipur or Breakaway. And, you know, she turned around and said to me, she says, you know, you're giving up consulting. There is an opportunity for us to do something. I mean, there's a longer story there, but long story short, there was an opportunity that presented itself in Goa. And she said, why don't we take this on and do something ourselves? Now, I've never done food, you know, I mean, food businesses.
Correct.
But the truth is that, you know, love for good food, love for all things beautiful, love for curating experiences, travel and product taught me that, you know, the underlying principle behind any business remains unchanged. Mm. You know, you have a strong proposition.
Correct.
You have your unit economics in place. You're good to go. And so, yeah, I think it was love of good food and love for Poonam.
And then what made you move to, you know, Bengali and French cuisine? I mean, that's a very unusual
combination. It is unusual, but I just said to you that, you know, there's really no point in setting up yet another Italian food place in Goa or yet another Goan food place.
Butter chicken.
Yeah, I mean, so the idea was to bring a cuisine to Goa, which Goa had not seen. Goa is like 4,000 eateries, you know, which kick alive in the season. So there was really no point in doing more of what was already available. And you can't build businesses, you can't build brands on cost leadership.
Correct.
I'm very mindful of that.
Yeah.
So we had to do something that would make people sit up and say, interesting. So that is what, you know, brought us to doing Bengali and therefore Mustard. But Poonam felt that Goa is a mixed bag of travelers from all over the world. We needed a neutral cuisine which would complement Bengali, but at the same time be far more neutral on the palate.
Mm.
And you know, when we look around, we found French. Mustard is to the French what Kashandi is to the Bengali. So yeah, so French and Bengali, and it's not fusion. I mean, you know, it's a big struggle for us to be able to convey the fact that we have two authentic
cuisines.
Menus.
Okay.
Because these days everybody thinks, oh, yeah, French meets Bengali might be.
You know, I always ask you the same question.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
Is it fusion?
But it's not. Mm. Yeah, yeah, it's not fusion.
And, you know, a restaurant business is a very difficult business.
It is.
You know, yeah. Not only is it a difficult business, but it's also very difficult to make money.
Yes.
How are you managing it?
It's a struggle.
Okay.
It's a struggle because of very many reasons. We're self-driven. We've built the business out of, you know, our deep convictions behind our approach to food, an honest, unpretentious way to present home-style food, which is not what commercial restaurants do, right? That also means that our focus on upping our game, not just in the quality of food, but also in the overall experience, so that you stay with Mustard as an experience long after you've come and had a meal.
Yes.
That means that there is a lot more that needs to be done than most people do, right? It's hard. The economics of, again, rentals and salaries, an industry with the highest level of attrition, you know, that one has, I have ever seen.
Yeah.
makes it a challenge on a day-to-day basis. But there are small joys. There is endorsement and acknowledgement and gratification, which keeps us going. Fantastic. So it's a very, very tightrope walk. Again, women in food, I think you have to work 5 times as hard to just stay there.
Amazing.
So, yeah, I mean, we do what we do because we believe in it.
Yeah. So, Shilpa, let me move to the second part of our show, which is, you've been a startup entrepreneur with three different things, and you were consulting.
Yes.
Lots of people watch our show, especially a lot of people are interested in startups. Mm. So I want to understand a few things from you. Number one is that, you have had partners in two of your ventures.
Yes.
What is your view on going solo versus having a partner?
There is a good side to going solo. I started Breakaway with two partners, but within a year we figured that we weren't really aligned. And it was evident to me that the only way forward was to let them go, because I wasn't going to be able to measure up to their expectations. And a realization very early on allowed for me to be done and dusted very quickly before each one of us got too invested. The advantages of having partners always is that it allows you to enlist the support of people who are good at things that you don't know.
Right.
None of us can be good at everything that we do. So having a partner who complements your skill set, your capabilities, is a great way to build businesses, because it allows you to lean on someone without having to hire people.
Correct.
Right? And early days of running businesses, you can't really afford to hire all the people, all the capabilities that you need. Mm. You've got to get some, founders, like-minded people on board. Somebody gets to play good cop and the other one gets to be bad cop. Yeah. If you're the sole person, then, you're trying to straddle that tightrope by yourself. Mm. Entrepreneurship is also a very, very lonely journey.
It is.
So, I think just having somebody to lean on from time to time when the chips are down, when, you're having a particularly bad time, is always good. That said, I've also learned that you can't always lean on your partners. So there are dynamics that kick in. There are things that you weren't prepared for. There are personality traits
Correct.
That start to overwhelm. So, I get asked this all the time, and I think there is no ideal way to do things. Listen to your inner gut about people. I don't think running businesses with friends is a great idea, because you can never tell the other where to get off. With Poonam and I, it was different. It started off as a professional engagement for over 10 years. And the friendship was an outcome of a professional association, which is very different from starting off as friends and then working together.
Correct.
Because it's just different.
I agree.
The truth is that, you can't be popular with everybody.
No. And certainly not your business
partner. Business partners, and then you start off by thinking there are synergies, and then you realize there aren't. And you find a way to enlist the support of people outside the system, which is where I think mentors play a great role.
Correct. So tell me, with three startups, and I'm sure you looked at many others and no friends, what in your opinion are some of the basic mistakes a lot of startup entrepreneurs make?
A lot of people these days are trying to create solutions to problems that don't exist. Problems that don't need solving. I mean, this whole piece about, bringing technology into our lives as a way of life,
Correct.
I think sometimes tends to push the envelope. So I think people don't spend a lot of young entrepreneurs, and I find myself saying this to them, whether in, classroom or in a one-on-one mentorship sessions, which I'm beginning to do a lot of these days. I find myself telling them to work very, very hard at their proposition. What is it that they're promising? Why do they need to make that promise? And how is it that they're going to make themselves unassailable, right? Because like I said earlier on, if you're an also-ran, it's not last. If you don't have your economics in place, no amount of funding can save a lopsided, cost to revenue equation.
Correct.
So, I think startup entrepreneurs should spend a lot of time figuring out why they exist, why the business needs to exist. What is it that gives them an advantage, an overarching advantage over competition? What is it that competition is not doing a good job of? Can you make that your unique proposition. So that's one. The other thing is that, you know, people are in way too much of a hurry to raise money. And having raised money, I know that there is a
pressure to expand.
There is a pitfall in terms of, you know, raising money too early on, you know, puts you on the back foot, you know, makes you give away a lot more than you otherwise would, doesn't let you do anything on your terms. And, you know, having raised money, then the race to just hire the best talent, get the fanciest offices, you know, people stop feeling the need to be tight-fisted, you know, to be very, very mindful of, you know, how they spend. All of that, I think, you know, comes back to bite you.
Very interesting.
Later on. And those are some of the things that...
Now, moving to the last part of our program, a few questions for you personally.
Sure.
You know, with all the experience that you have and lots of success, what would be three adjectives that describe you?
Okay. I'm very persistent.
Okay.
Compassionate.
Okay.
And I must say multifaceted. If that's in a... if it's an adjective. But yeah, that kind of pretty much sums up the person I am.
Yeah. I get that sense even while talking to you.
Yeah. I mean, people say to me, you know, we don't know whether to hug you or to throw you off the fourth floor. But the point is that I always I push people a lot. But I think the reason why I get away with it is because I push myself as much, if not more. And that then allows me to just, you know, build relationships that go way beyond professional engagements. And today, most of my great friendships are an outcome of professional associations.
Terrific. Yeah. Terrific. So my last question to you now. A lot of us see failure, but Indians and Asians somehow do not want to talk of failure, nor do we teach children failure. I've got a new book coming out in a few months on failure.
Right.
What has been some of your learnings from some of your mistakes or failures?
You know, you're very right when you say that it's very hard for us to talk about our failures. Because somewhere we feel that it undermines
or makes you look weak.
Vulnerable. Makes you vulnerable, yeah. But also as we grow, as we get on, I mean, I think I'm at a stage in my life where I've learned that, you know, it's okay to be vulnerable. It's okay to be not great at, you know, whatever it is that you're choosing to do. I don't want my life to all be about getting, you know, to be great at what I'm good at. Because, yeah, I mean, it comes with a price. Failure to manage relationships, personal and professional, teaches us many lessons in humility, in compassion, in, you know, just our approach to the way we build teams, the way we conduct ourselves in the workplace. Picking and choosing your battles, you know, you can't win them all. I think just to be more grounded, more mindful, more respectful, and more willing to embrace circumstances. I mean, there have been circumstances completely out of my control. Mm-hmm. There have been curveballs that life has thrown at me that left me with no choice but to embrace them because there was no way to fight them.
Correct.
You know, life intervenes in every which way. And so you say, okay, you know, bring it on.
Wonderful.
There is a lesson in here for me. And up until I'm able to glean the lesson that there is to learn, I will allow myself to roll with the punches.
Terrific.
And I just think that it's just made me the person I am today.
So, fantastic.
Yeah.
Shilpa, thank you very much. That's been an absolutely incredible conversation.
Thank you very much.
And of course, a special thank you to you for making that additional effort of introducing so many more women.
But there are so many more women out there whose stories need to be told, yes.
So thank you very much.
Pleasure.
And great talk.
Always. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You podcast. Be sure to visit tbcy.in to join the conversation, access show notes, and discover fantastic bonus content. You can follow us on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Simply search for The Brand Called You. Thank you, and see you next week.